The following program is produced and paid for by Star Arizona.
You're listening to Star Arizona's Let's Talk Stars with your hosts, David and Wendy Levy. David is a science editor of Parade Magazine, the author of over two dozen books, and the discoverer of 21 comets, including Comet Shoemaker-Levy 9. David and Wendy can also be heard on the World Wide Web at letstalkstars.com. Now here's David and Wendy.
Good morning, everyone, and good afternoon or evening, depending on when you're listening to this. And welcome to Let's Talk Stars, taped live at Jarnac Observatory. Today, our guest is Al Nagler. And we are having the show as part of our basic series on telescopes, eyepieces, and mounts. Good morning, Al. How are you?
Fine, thank you, David. How are you?
Oh, well, very well. And very excited because when we do a show that has to do with the basic parts of a telescope and the things that you need in a telescope, I cannot imagine having a more appropriate guest on our show than you to talk about eyepieces.
Well, thank you very much.
I wanted to begin by asking you, why eyepieces? What got you into eyepieces, specifically into telescope eyepieces?
Well, I had been working at an optical company, Ferrand Optical Company, for a number of years doing simulators and other esoterica for both the space program and also some eyepieces for the night vision goggles program for the Army. But I'd always been an amateur astronomer. And then one day it kind of struck me when I saw some advanced optical designs that kind of led me to the possibility of making an ultra-wide angle eyepiece that was really sharp. I've been using Erfel eyepieces for years, mostly war surplus Erfels, and they weren't very sharp at the center, and they weren't very sharp at the edge, but they had a nice big field of view. And having designed a simulator for the lunar landing program, by the way, I give a talk on that titled Giant Eyepieces That Swallow Spacecraft. And for those people who might think that I've been involved in making big eyepieces, I'd just like to point out the specs of that particular, quote, eyepiece as a simulator. It had a 110-degree field, 3-foot eye relief, and 1-foot exit pupil. So there you go.
Wow.
That's a big eyepiece.
Well, you could practically walk into that eyepiece.
Yes, yeah. And that's what the astronauts did, looking out their windows. But the point is this, having that experience of looking out the LEM window at this gigantic field of view display to infinity, it really bugged me that amateur astronomers couldn't have this experience. And I felt as an amateur, I was at a point knowing a little bit about the technology, that it was worthwhile trying to move in that direction of getting a, quote, spacewalk type eyepiece. And that's really what led to the Nagler eyepiece.
When were you doing that?
That was in actually the late 70s.
I
had the idea when we worked on the simulators in the late 60s, but it took a while to really kind of coalesce and let me have the gumption to go into a business where I could develop something like this.
And let's go back a little bit to an earlier time. And you and I come from a hobby that we've turned into something a lot more than a hobby, where eyepieces were a lot simpler. When we started, you could get a Kellner eyepiece, you could get an Erfel eyepiece for wide field, and I remember that generally the eyepiece was the last thing you thought about when you got a telescope. You got the telescope, did as well as you could getting the optics, the mirror that was as good as possible, and then you just throw in a Kellner.
Right, and eyepiece just came along with it.
Yeah, and that's not the way it's done anymore. And I think those days are happy to be over, because I know that one of the telescopes that I have, which is my favorite, is an 8-inch F7 from Cave Optical. And it was always a good telescope, but it was not until I put in the Nagler eyepieces that I finally began to realize how special that telescope was. They allowed this particular 8-inch to perform so beautifully that it now is, even though I have larger instruments, that this one is now the best of the scopes that I've got right now. And but it takes the proper eyepiece, the best eyepieces. So I think when you're getting seriously into astronomy and into telescopes, that you need to put as much care into choosing the eyepieces you're going to get as you do with anything else, the mounting, the tube assembly, anything else with the telescope. I'm wondering if we could start by asking you to sort of give us a bit of an overview as to the kinds of eyepieces that are important for astronomical imaging and viewing.
Well, the ideal eyepiece, of course, should replicate the kind of high-fidelity view, if you will, that the naked eye experiences, which is an incredibly wide 135 degrees, has a resolution of one arc minute, fine color correction, and everything else. So it's a little bit like the Hippocratic Oath, first do no harm. And it's with any optical system, it's very easy to do harm unless you try to get everything right. And because it's not possible to get everything right, you're left with a series of compromises. And the question is, what compromises are you willing to make? In the early days, when you and I started with our skyscopes, you had slow telescopes, which were relatively forgiving in terms of eyepiece quality, and Kellners and Huygens and other eyepieces, even Erfels, looked pretty good with those slow telescopes. But as telescopes grew, and you have the Dobsonian revolution, and you have fast instruments, that puts much greater demands on the quality of the eyepiece. And indeed, as Jack Marling once said, the eyepieces have the telescope, so use the best. So for me, it's almost a little bit like a religious devotion. If you're given this wonderful, magical eyesight capability, and you're given this fabulous universe we exist in, my feeling is, if you're going to view it as best as you can, and if you're going to make compromises, don't make them in terms of the quality of the viewing experience. So that's always been my philosophy.
And of course, that has to do with everything in a telescope. When people say, what's the most important part of a telescope? Well, it's everything.
Yeah, you can't separate it out. It's like a fancy stereo system. You're only as good as your weakest link. So you've got to have a great telescope and hopefully great eyepieces. And even when you have a great telescope, a wonderful hundredth wave parabola, turns out a parabola has coma, and then you have to worry about correcting the coma. Some people think it's done in the eyepiece, but really, it isn't. So we can get into that in a little greater detail later if you wish.
Sure.
Al, I would now, coming from the novice status, and David thinks I know more than I do, but I really don't know very much about eyepieces at all. If I come up to you being the novice and I'm saying, Al, I just got my first telescope, and let's say I just got an 8-inch, because that's the average telescope most amateur astronomers get, and I want to buy my eyepieces. Can you give me a eyepiece 101 discussion on what I'm looking for in eyepieces and which particular sizes would be the best ones to have?
Okay, now that's a toughie. Fortunately, we have a little help in that on our website, teleview.com, we put this very nice eyepiece calculator where you can put in the any two parameters of the telescope, focal length, aperture, or focal ratio, and then you could get all the information on the fields of view and the exit pupil, and sort by the field of view or design and so on. So I'd recommend anybody who wants to explore this in some detail to look at our website where we have these resources, the article that I did for Sky and Tell on magnification, a section on how telescopes, binoculars, and cameras work, this eyepiece calculator, and a whole section on how to choose eyepieces. So there is a lot of raw material there, and it's probably worth a novice looking at it, and then perhaps giving us a call if they have any questions. Mm-hmm. But let's get down to the basics, and I think I'd like to get across what an eyepiece actually is, because I think a lot of people don't really understand what an eyepiece does. So if you don't mind, I'd like to take a minute and go right to the basics.
Oh, please.
Take two.
Okay. First thing is, you have a telescope which forms an image, and it's very much like a camera lens forming an image on a film plane, and people understand how that's done. So let's imagine you've got any telescope, and you've got an image. You could put a piece of film there and record the image. And let's say the image is a certain size, the size of a 35-millimeter frame. Well, the field of view, that's your field of view. And the field of view is simply the diameter of the film image divided by the focal length of the telescope. That forms a little narrow triangle, and that is your field of view. If you multiply that number by a radian, 57.3 degrees, you get your true field in degrees. So that's what the telescope does. Now, what the eyepiece does is take the size of that film, plane, if you will, or what's available, and look at a portion of it and magnify it. An eyepiece is like a magnifier, and it converts that real image to an angle projected at infinity into your eye. So, for example, if you have a 1-inch diameter field on your for your telescope, you would see that eyepieces have field stops, and this is something we've been promulgating recently in terms of clarifying how to get the true field. A field stop represents, in effect, the size of that film. So the eyepiece field stop is converted optically by the lenses to an infinity display and projects it into your eye and translates that diameter into an angular diameter of the field at your eye. So that's the principle of an eyepiece. And if you understand that, you could see that for a given eyepiece, if you have a larger field coming into your eye, which is called the apparent field, that translates to a larger portion of the image or the film size that the telescope will produce. So for a given magnification, if you have a larger apparent field, you will see more area in the sky and it will be more realistic. And that's one of the reasons why we always point to larger fields. So that's the basic idea of how an eyepiece works.
Okay.
Okay.
If that was a little too much for one gulp, maybe if somebody sees a picture of it on our website, it would become hopefully instantly clear.
Right, because I was thinking that was
The general idea is that the field of view has nothing to do with the lenses in the eyepiece. It only has to do with the field stop or the opening that's presented to the eyepiece.
So let's go back a little bit. You have light from the moon, say. It's going through your telescope, and it hits the mirror or it goes through the lens, and it gets to the end of its travel at the little hole at the other end of the eyepiece where your eye is about to go. You put an eyepiece at that place.
Well, actually, it comes to an image at the focal plane, and
right.
You put the eyepiece to view the focal plane as a magnifier. Then you end up with a little hole where you put your eye, and that hole sees this large angle in the eyepiece.
So theoretically, you don't need an eyepiece. The image has formed at a one power level.
Yes.
At the focal point that's created by the size and the focal length, focal ratio of the mirror or
exactly.
the lens.
Exactly. And in fact, if I don't want to bother looking through a finder scope or one of our star beams, I'll just take the eyepiece out, stand back a foot, and look at the image there, and I can see whether the moon or the planet is in the field of view.
Right, exactly. So the image is actually formed by the objective lens or by the mirror. And by putting an eyepiece at that focal point, what happens?
You're using the eyepiece as a giant magnifying glass, and you're taking the linear size of that image in the focal plane, and you're translating it to a large apparent field angle at your eye, mm-hmm. and it's brought into your eye at a point called the exit pupil. The exit pupil is simply an image that the eyepiece forms of the objective lens. Mm-hmm. All of these formulas, again, are in describing these things in detail or in the books, or they're on our website in our articles and so on.
And that website, again, is www.televue.com.
And so
TELEVUE.com,
yes.
Right.
We're going to take a brief commercial break right now, and we will be back with Al Nagler of Televue Optics talking about eyepieces, the love of his life in astronomy, and so important for anybody trying to observe through a telescope. You are listening to StarZona's Let's Talk Stars, taped live at the Jarnac Observatory. Wendy, we have talked in these commercials that we do for StarZona about the many products that they have, but one of the things that they do have at StarZona is a choice of eyepieces.
And even some of those are the Nagler eyepieces.
They feature Nagler eyepieces.
That's right.
And in a way...
That's where you got yours.
Yes, that's where I got my 31. And in a way, you could say that the Nagler eyepieces are the Cadillacs, the Mercedes of the eyepiece world. These are wonderful, wonderful eyepieces, and you can get just about any one of them, the full line of Nagler eyepieces, available at StarZona.
Well, before we go back to the interview, I have to say every time somebody sees a Nagler eyepiece, I hear them, or when you pull yours up, they go, "You have a Nagler?" And when we're at Stellafane and Al will give some of the eyepieces as part of the raffle prizes, everyone's there going, "I want the Naglers, I want the Naglers." They don't care about anything else. All they want is the Naglers.
That is very true, no matter what they give as the raffle prizes at Stellafane.
It's always, "I want the Nagler."
It's the Nagler eyepieces that are the top of the line and the things that the people really want.
As a matter of fact, Al, I think one year I put in $40 in raffle tickets just to get the Naglers, and we didn't win them.
Well, sorry about that. We'll have to bring up some more next year.
Dean wanted us to do live commercials for StarZona, and I think this is what he got this time.
Okay, well, that's great. We appreciate the live commercial and the thoughts and sincerity behind it. Thank you very much.
Well, these Nagler eyepieces are featured at StarZona on their website at www.starzona.com, and they will make your observing experience even more wonderful. And one of the things you can do with any eyepiece, especially the Naglers, is put them in to what Wendy likes to call the twisty-turny thing, or the virtual view, so that when you're using a Celestron or Meade telescope and the angle of the eyepiece is okay for you, but it isn't okay for your slightly vertically challenged young daughter or son, then with this almost feather touch device, you simply turn the eyepiece so that it is at the perfect angle for viewing. So all of these devices to make your observing more palatable and even more fun. At StarZona, adventures in astronomy and nature.
Since time long forgotten, we have been mystified by the sky. Now, all the magic of the universe can be yours with Deep Space Explorer from Space.com software. Call forth miraculous places, each a true wonder of the sky. Fly much faster than the speed of light, and dare to challenge the powerful forces of the cosmos. Deep Space Explorer is easy to use. Your Windows or Macintosh computer becomes a powerful time machine and starship, voyaging hundreds of millions of light years from home. And Deep Space Explorer is now available at Starzona, 5201 North Oracle Road in Tucson. Unlock the mysteries of deep space. Conjure wondrous visions for guidance. But this sorcery is real science. Be the wizard of your universe. With Deep Space Explorer, it's a perfect gift for intelligent life. At Starzona and starzona.com on North Oracle Road in Tucson.
This is Adam Block from Kitt Peak. Discover your universe tonight. The Mountain and Gift Shop are open daily from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. Participate in tours of the large telescopes and enjoy the nature that surrounds you. Every night, we witness the splendor of the night sky during our nightly observing program. This program includes a box meal, and after viewing the sunset, the public uses star charts, binoculars, and our visitor center telescopes to see everything from planets to other galaxies. If this early evening program whets your appetite for more, consider the all-night observing program. What better way of learning about astronomy than becoming an astronomer for a night? Whether you wish to view celestial vistas with your own eyes or capture them with a CCD camera, you will be in charge with your own telescope operator to assist you in a hands-on experience. These programs are very popular. Reservations are typically made months in advance. Don't forget, expect cold conditions and to have the time of your life. For more information, please visit our web pages at www.noao.edu/outreach. For questions and reservations, call us at 520-318-8726. That's 520-318-8726.
A brilliant image, razor sharp from edge to edge, a wide field of view, powerful magnification, yet easy to hold in your hand. It's Canon's new 10x30 image stabilizing binoculars now at Starzona. Thanks to Canon's world-renowned lens technology, the 10x30 image stabilizer delivers high magnification with extraordinary image quality that lets you really see the details. Too much power to handhold? Not these binoculars. They feature an advanced active optical image stabilizer based on Canon's innovative vari-angle prism. It gives you a steady image without a tripod, even in a moving car. What's more, Canon's superbly engineered eyepiece optics give you a crisp, undistorted view with no blurring at the edges. You get the full view even if you wear eyeglasses. Compact, lightweight, affordable, and backed by Canon's 1-year international warranty and 2-year extended USA warranty, the 10x30 image stabilizers are the binoculars you've been waiting for. See it and other outstanding Canon binoculars at Starzona.
You're listening to Starzona's Let's Talk Stars with your hosts, David and Wendy Levy. David is a science editor of Parade Magazine, the author of over 2 dozen books, and the discoverer of 21 comets, including Comet Shoemaker-Levy 9. David and Wendy can also be heard on the World Wide Web at letstalkstars.com. Now here's David and Wendy.
Welcome back to Starzona's Let's Talk Stars, where our guest today is Al Nagler of Teleview Optics. Al, you know, let's go back again to when we started the show, and in an age where eyepieces were the afterthought. Thanks to you, I think thanks to you, they are no longer. They have reached their rightful position as a third of the key, the triad that is necessary to have a good, successful observing experience with a telescope. Tell us about how you started Teleview and what the first eyepiece that you put together was.
Okay. As I mentioned, I worked for this optical company, and how I got to the optical company is interesting because the chief project engineer was a man by the name of Earl Brown, who has written articles in the old ATM books and was the Gleanings for ATM editor at Sky and Telescope, and I knew this. So I wrangled a job there because what could be better than being associated with somebody who's involved with Sky and Telescope? And then I was ushered from a draftsman's job into the optical design department, where I learned my craft for about 17 years. In any case, that's how it started, And while the impetus was to get something like the Nagler eyepiece going, I realized that having an eyepiece that cost 10 times as much as the ordinary eyepiece, has maybe 3 times the field and 3 times the eye relief and 5 times the sharpness, was kind of a big stretch, and to go out there with an unknown company, I thought that was a little much, so I stepped back a little bit and I redesigned the Plossl series of eyepieces, which is an eyepiece pretty much standard, consisting of 2 doublets, and I previously had Clave Plossls and lots of other eyepieces.
And when you say 2 doublets, you mean a doublet is a...
doublet is 2 cemented lenses.
Yeah.
And the Plossl consists of 2 doublets.
Yeah.
So 4 lenses altogether, 2 of them, both pairs cemented.
Right.
And I knew this was a fairly common design and relatively easy to manufacture. And I made some improvements and got my first eyepiece patent based on that design. The improvements in that design, which were basically to improve the edge sharpness by eliminating or minimizing astigmatism. In any case, being able to produce a relatively low-cost design, a very high quality, I felt would allow me to introduce the company. And if the company were successful, then it would be much easier to introduce this relatively radical concept. By the way, your listeners may not know that eyepieces are typically named after their designers, right, from Ramsden, Huygens, mm-hmm. Erfel, Plossl, and so on. And although it was with a little trepidation I added the Nagler name, I felt it was not out of kilter in terms of the tradition in the field.
It's also a testimony to the pride with which you design these eyepieces. You're adding your own personal name to them. It means they got to be good, and it has to be the very best that you can come up with.
Well, I appreciate that. But certainly I felt a Plossl, a modification to a Plossl or an improvement, it was still based on Mr. Plossl's work, and I didn't feel it was appropriate to attach my name, but when introducing something a little more radical, I thought that was the time. In any case, so I had left that optical company and worked at a small camera manufacturer, which allowed me to travel to Japan and find some sources, which I was later able to use to develop the eyepieces. So it's funny the
you
way things
sources,
work, but everything adds up in the end after all, fortunately. But getting the Plossls going, we had a big boost from Richard Berry, who wrote an article in Astronomy called Sharpest Eyepieces I've Ever Used. So that kind of kicked us off around 1980.
What was the first, when did the first Nagler eyepiece, when was that introduced?
I think that was around, incidentally, fortunately, I pulled off a copy of our Teleview chronology, which is also on our website, and so I can go back and look at this. But the first Naglers were introduced around 1980.
Yeah.
That was with the 13.9 and 4.8 millimeter focal lengths.
Right.
Yeah, now we're up to God knows how many eyepieces with focal lengths, Naglers, of 2.5 millimeters up to 31.
Yeah.
So fortunately, new glasses and new design programs and so on allow us to still make progress.
Okay, so Al, going back to my 8-inch telescope.
Okay, sorry.
What?
That was quite a roundabout tour. Let's get right back to that.
Let me give you the bottom line question. First eyepieces, what should I get?
Okay. First, I have a question for you. Do you wear glasses to correct astigmatism?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Then that would suggest eyepieces with ideally 18 to 20 millimeters of eye relief, which is the distance from the lens to your eye where the image, that little circle where all the light comes through, and in order to use your glasses to correct astigmatism, you'd want to have that long eye release.
So I would still use my glasses with your eyepiece?
Yes, because you want to correct the astigmatism.
Correct. Well,
now, at low power, where you have a large exit pupil, it's very important. But at high power, it may not be important because you'd have a small exit pupil coming into your eye. It's like stopping down your eye. And one test I suggest people make before they go on this quest for eyepieces is to take a piece of cardboard and with a pen, make a bunch of small holes, say from a millimeter up to 2 millimeters or a half millimeter up to 2 millimeters. Look through that and see at what point, if you have astigmatism, you'll probably find at some aperture size, the astigmatism disappears because you're using the smallest and best part of your eye. And if you know that, it means you don't need your glasses at high power.
Okay,
people
Al,
who don't have astigmatism can always refocus the eyepiece.
Al, this is pretty important. I'm going to ask you to repeat this test, the Nagler test.
Okay.
This is very important.
The high-tech, unique, expensive Nagler test.
Hey, Al, I'm going to try this because I always use my glasses, and I want to know when I can take my glasses off.
Well, this is one way to find out. You simply make some small holes in a piece of cardboard and hold the cardboard with the holes up to your eye.
Now, you gave the holes a size beginning.
Well, you can pick. It doesn't really matter. You just go from
tiny to bigger?
Yeah, from half a millimeter to 3 millimeters or something. And just with a pen, you can just punch holes with a ballpoint pen and piece of cardboard. And just get a sense of at what point you're comfortable. Now, I realized this a while ago in looking through binoculars, where you have a big exit pupil in a binocular, 7 millimeters in a 7x50, and you'll see a lot of your own astigmatism and eye limitations. But then if you have a very small exit pupil in a high-powered binocular, you notice you don't need your glasses and you still see sharp images. So the idea is to at least understand with your own eyesight at what point you can comfortably remove your glasses. That's just a little help because you may not always want 20 millimeters of eye relief. There's nothing wrong with that, but you've got more options if you understand what your limitations are. So let's assume you do have some astigmatism, which a lot of us do, and you're going to want at least 3 eyepieces for your telescope. Generally, a low power wide angle so you see large areas of the sky or the moon, open clusters and lots of nice wide angle objects, diffuse nebula, the Orion Nebula, the North American Nebula, and so on. So you want one low power eyepiece. And then you go to the other extreme and say, given my atmospheric conditions, given the quality of my telescope optics, what is a reasonable high power limit for that telescope? And then what you're doing is you're setting the focal length, basically. You've got the focal length of the high-powered eyepiece will determine the magnification, the maximum magnification for use in planets, double stars, the moon, and so on. And for low power, you want the maximum field of view for finding and seeing the field of view capability of the telescope. And then you want some one or two eyepieces in between. So we want to really start at the extremes.
Uh-huh.
So when I first get my telescope, I get myself a low power, a high power, and then as I get into this better, then I sort of find the interim.
Well, I think you'll find that the mid power is probably the one that's used the most, so you'll need it, I would guess, at least 3. Let's look at the case, for example, of a typical 8-inch Schmidt-Cassegrain F10 telescope, very popular instrument. Assuming you have just an inch and a quarter focuser, you will want one eyepiece that uses the, that allows you to see the maximum field of view with that inch and a quarter focuser. And if you look, for example, on our charts, you will see there are several eyepieces that have a 27 millimeter field stop, which is the largest diameter opening you can have in an inch and a quarter eyepiece. So clearly, one of those would be appropriate. Now, we happen, as an example, to make three different eyepieces with that same field stop, a 40 millimeter, a 32 millimeter, and a 24 millimeter panoptic. Mm-hmm. Now, they will all give you the same true field. So what's the difference? You've got to pick one of those as an example, and you might as well, if you can afford the little extra cost, pick the 24 millimeter, because it's going to give you a 68 degree apparent field and a greater magnification with your telescope. Magnification of the telescope is the focal length divided by the focal length of the eyepiece. So 2,000 divided by 24 gives you 83 power.
Always that, remembering to put them in the same types of units. So you don't want to...
Right, millimeters and millimeters.
Yes.
Well, that's typical, right? Don't you? Yeah. You can't use 8 inches or 6 feet of focal length or whatever. Use millimeters and millimeters.
Right.
But that's pretty much standard these days. So in any case, the low power would suggest using this 24 millimeter panoptic to get the largest field at the highest magnification, because the highest magnification, it works out, gives you the smallest exit pupil, which best matches your eye aberrations, gives you the darkest background, which enhances the contrast and allows you to see faint stars. So you would always generally pick the largest field of view, largest apparent field of view possible with a given field size. Now, in your case, it becomes a little bit more difficult because that eyepiece doesn't have 20 millimeters of eye relief. Has about 15 or 16. So you might want to choose the 32 millimeter Plossel, which has, I think, about 24 millimeters of eye relief. And that'll give you the same field of view. So in that way, you've picked your low power eyepiece. You do have one other option. You can upgrade the telescope by adding a 2-inch diagonal, which the Teleview also makes. And that allows you to use eyepieces with larger field stops, up to 46 millimeters, which corresponds to larger areas of the sky. So there are many options, but trying to keep it simple, let's just say for your case, a 32 Plossel would be the best low-power eyepiece. Next, let's go to the highest power eyepiece.
I'm listening.
Okay.
Okay, now it's often said, well, 50 power per inch of aperture. There are lots of rules of thumb in astronomy, and it's good to ignore a lot of rules of thumb because a lot of them are on ancient wives' tales and come from other sources that get repeated and become shibboleths after a couple of centuries. And in fact, on our website in the magnification article, we produce we have a section on myths, common telescope myths. So let's just ignore the 50 power per inch or guideline like that. Let's go back to basics. The basics is for high power, you want to see resolution. You want to see the finest detail you can see on the moon or a planet. And that's limited by your telescope quality, your telescope aperture, and your atmospheric scene. Let's assume that the atmosphere allows you to see, one arc second where you are. I think that's fairly typical. Maybe a half an arc second is about the best you can do. David, you could probably fill me in on, you know, what your experience is on this.
That's about right. Where we live, the seeing can be pretty, pretty good, but generally, an arc second, which is, let's see, about something in the sky. If you want to separate a double star, with a separation of 1 second of arc, then that's typically we're able to do that from where we are.
Okay. So let's walk through a scenario, and let's use that as a guideline. Let's say you want to comfortably see 1 arc second or have that capability with your telescope. The best human eye can resolve 1 arc minute. And golly, that means all you need is 60 power to see the resolution limit of the telescope. Not widely known fact, which is only about 11 power per inch of aperture. So the fact is you can typically see the resolution at much lower power, but you don't want to strain your eyes very much. So you'd like to go at least 3 times the minimum. So 3 times 60 is 180. And therefore, something in the 200 power range would be ideal as a high power eyepiece. Everything beyond that is giving you what's called empty magnification. It's like getting too close to a TV set and seeing the pixels.
Right.
You're just not gaining. In fact, it's more comfortable to use the lower power if you can see the detail, you have a brighter image, more contrast, and so on. So that leads me to recommend something in the 9 or 10 millimeter focal length range. 10 millimeters would give you exactly 200 power. And in fact, Teleview makes a 10 millimeter radian eyepiece with a 60 degree apparent field and 20 millimeters of eye relief that would allow you to do that. So now you have a 10 millimeter eyepiece for the high power, a 32 millimeter eyepiece for the lowest power, and you need something for the great in between, which is where the most fun usually lies when you're viewing globular clusters and the Orion Nebula and so on. So, if you wanted to pick one eyepiece in between, you would say, well, let's just split the difference and have maybe 15 millimeters or so. Well, it turns out, at least in the Teleview line, we happen to have a Nagler Type 4 eyepiece with an 82 apparent degree field that has a 12 millimeter focal length, and it fits 1.25 inch focusers. The significance of that is it also has over 17 millimeters of eye relief. So now you've got the eye relief that you want for your astigmatism. You've got the maximum field you can get in an eyepiece at a given focal length, and you've got a power. Well, actually, the 12 millimeter would be somewhat of an alternate to the to your 10, and it may be a better idea just to get the 12, forget about the 10, unless you really need higher power, and then get another eyepiece like an 8 or a 9 to go over the 200. So the 12 millimeter that I'm suggesting gives you both very high power. You've got 2,000 divided by 12, so you've got 167 power, which is comfortably near the maximum. You've got this great big field of view, and you have the eye relief. And it may be that with just the 12 Nagler Type 4 and the 32, you really only need 2 eyepieces. And if you look up on the charts, you see that the 12 millimeter Nagler, because of the big apparent field, has what's called a field stop of 17.1. Now that field stop number is directly proportional to the true field you're seeing in the sky. So if we said the 32 millimeter has 27 millimeters of field stop, the 12 millimeter will have 17.1, right?
Yes.
Divided by 27, it will have 63% of the field of view of the low power eyepiece. So you've got a really nice combination there, actually, with just 2 eyepieces. You got a low power with a maximum field of view, and you got a pretty good high power with 63% of the field of the low power.
So,
and I think, David, you have enough experience that you can probably bear this out.
So really, if you were to get the, let's go again, the two eyepieces, really, which are all that you need, would be which ones?
A 12 Nagler Type 4.
Right.
And a 32 Plossel.
And a 32 Plossel.
There you go.
Interesting.
And so the beauty of the, if you will, the 12 millimeter is that because it has such a big field stop, it's intruding into the field areas that you'd normally use a lower power eyepiece for. So you're getting in one eyepiece the field of view and the power and the dark sky background and the resolution. So I'm sorry if this sounds a little too much like a commercial, but I'm kind of enthusiastic about this. This particular scenario.
Don't blame you.
Actually, Al, that sounds really good because I'm one of these efficient type people, and to know, and if you think about it, to be able to use two eyepieces instead of three, I look at the money that it would save somebody and the lack of extra pieces of equipment to carry around when they do their observing. So that makes it really, really nice.
Yeah, another way of looking at this is if you were to buy a Plossel eyepiece of the same field stop, the same size, and we do make it. A Plossel has a 50-degree apparent field with a 17.1-millimeter field stop in the 20-millimeter focal length. So you're getting the power of the 12-millimeter with the field of a 20 Plossel.
One question before we break for our second commercial batch. And we've been talking about the field of view, and we've been tossing around different types of numbers. One of them, the apparent field of an eyepiece, and the other is the actual field of an eyepiece. What is the difference?
The actual field, also called the true field, depends only on the field stop of the eyepiece and the focal length of the telescope. Yeah. That's the area you see in the sky. The eyepiece takes that area and stretches it in an angular fashion and brings it to your eye. So, for example, a half a degree moon at 100 power is going to be 50 degrees as
right.
it hits your eye.
Yeah.
And that is the apparent field of the moon. It may coincide with the 50 degree of the eyepiece. So when you look at the apparent field of an eyepiece, all you have to do is look into the eyepiece without even a telescope, and you will see a big ring, a big circle, black circle surrounding a white field if you just hold the eyepiece up, and that circle is the apparent field of view. So you've got two main factors. You've got the apparent field, and you've got the field stop, and the field stop in effect is translated by the eyepiece into the apparent field.
Okay. And on that note, we're going to take our second commercial break, and we will be back in just a moment with our guest, Al Nagler of Teleview Optics, talking about eyepieces, and also when we get back, a moment in time and space. You are listening to StarZona's Let's Talk Stars, taped live at the Charnak Observatory. When we talk about basics and observing basics, one of the best sources of information is to go to StarZona's website, www.starzona.com. You have a veritable course on how to get started in astronomy, the kinds of telescopes that you should look at, kinds of eyepieces, kinds of other things to do with imaging if you want to get into photographs, using CCDs, mountings, all kinds of things that are needed for a satisfying observing experience. All of this is available on StarZona's website, which was written and prepared by Dean Koenig and his friend Scott Tucker. This website is really a wonderful way of getting started in astronomy, getting started in what is rapidly turning in for you, I'm sure, to be a very serious avocation. Again, that website is www.starzona.com. It also has links to many other important websites in the field to give you an idea of how to get the best bang for your buck in observing. Again, that's StarZona, www.starzona.com. From StarZona, Adventures in Astronomy and Nature.
Since time long forgotten, we have been mystified by the sky. Now, all the magic of the universe can be yours with Deep Space Explorer. From Space.com software, call forth miraculous places, each a true wonder of the sky. Fly much faster than the speed of light, and dare to challenge the powerful forces of the cosmos. Deep Space Explorer is easy to use. Your Windows or Macintosh computer becomes a powerful time machine and starship, voyaging hundreds of millions of light years from home. And Deep Space Explorer is now available at StarZona, 5201 North Oracle Road in Tucson. Unlock the mysteries of deep space. Conjure wondrous visions for guidance. But this sorcery is real science. Be the wizard of your universe. With Deep Space Explorer, it's a perfect gift for intelligent life. At StarZona and StarZona.com.
In the sunset, the public uses star charts, binoculars, and our visitor center telescopes to see everything from planets to other galaxies. If this early evening program whets your appetite for more, consider the all-night observing program. What better way of learning about astronomy than becoming an astronomer for a night? Whether you wish to view celestial vistas with your own eyes or capture them with a CCD camera, you will be in charge with your own telescope operator to assist you in a hands-on experience. These programs are very popular. Reservations are typically made months in advance. Don't forget, expect cold conditions and to have the time of your life. For more information, please visit our web pages at www.noao.edu/outreach. For questions and reservations, call us at 520-318-8726. That's 520-318-8726.
A brilliant image, razor sharp from edge to edge, a wide field of view, powerful magnification, yet easy to hold in your hand. It's Canon's new 10x30 image stabilizing binoculars now at StarZona. Thanks to Canon's world-renowned lens technology, the 10x30 image stabilizer delivers high magnification with extraordinary image quality that lets you really see the details. Too much power to handhold? Not these binoculars. They feature an advanced active optical image stabilizer based on Canon's innovative vari-angle prism. It gives you a steady image without a tripod, even in a moving car. What's more, Canon's superbly engineered eyepiece optics give you a crisp, undistorted view with no blurring at the edges. You get the full view even if you wear eyeglasses. Compact, lightweight, affordable, and backed by Canon's 1-year international warranty and 2-year extended USA warranty, the 10x30 image stabilizers are the binoculars you've been waiting for. See it and other outstanding Canon binoculars at StarZona.
You're listening to StarZona's Let's Talk Stars with your hosts, David and Wendy Levy. David is a science editor of Parade Magazine, the author of over 24 books, and the discoverer of 21 comets, including Comet Shoemaker-Levy 9. David and Wendy can also be heard on the World Wide Web at letstalkstars.com. Now here's David and Wendy.
For this particular edition of A Moment in Time and Space, I would like to take you back once again to Stellafane. The year is 1980, and people are gathering at the conference. Stellafane tends to be a place where the tried and true gather, people who have had a lot of experience in observing, a lot of experience with telescopes, and mingle with beginners, people just getting started, and their families. And usually each year, some kind of major change comes in. I remember one year when the Dobson Revolution was really becoming part of the lexicon at Stellafane. But I don't remember any time where Stellafane was abuzz with more excitement than it was in the summer of 1980. People were walking around the buzzword was Nagler eyepiece. If I remember correctly, it was a 13 millimeter Nagler and a 4.8 millimeter Nagler that had just been introduced, and it was being displayed. And Al was there, and he had a telescope set up. People were telling other people. I heard about it as soon as I got to my camping area. I parked, got out of the car, and someone said, if you leave this cellophane with nothing else, get a look through the Nagler eyepiece. It was almost as if we had been visited by a religious experience. People for hundreds of years had been brought up in the telescope designs of Jesse Ramsden from the 1800s, of Kellner, of Plossel, but now there was something truly different, truly unique. The idea of being able to take a telescope that you have had for a lifetime and turn it into a totally new instrument with the addition of one of these Nagler eyepieces was truly remarkable. And I think of all the cellophanes I've been to, the one in 1980, when the Naglers were introduced, is one I will truly never forget. And this is this week's edition of A Moment in Time and Space. Welcome back to Starzona's Let's Talk Stars, taped live at the Jarnac Observatory. And our guest today is Al Nagler, the man who turned cellophane upside down in 1980.
Thank you very much for that story. I have to tell you just a short anecdote that the first time I had gone to a Texas Star Party and looked through a 17-inch Dob with my 13-millimeter eyepiece was the first time in my life I had ever gotten goosebumps looking through a telescope.
I know.
It certainly affected me as well in many ways.
Well, I have to say, Al, I've been actually very spoiled because we use your eyepieces here. And then we go off someplace else, and there's usually an astronomy group that will bring their telescopes outside of a place where David's lecturing. So as the people come out, they have their own little star party. And I have no idea what the eyepieces were or the conditions of their telescopes, but I would look through an 8-inch telescope, a typical amateur one, and they'd say, look, this is Jupiter. And all I'd see is a white disk, and I'm thinking, where are the bands? And I would just say, well, thank you very much. This is very nice. And think, David, I want to look through our telescope. But now, Al, I have a question for you about the eyepiece compatibility. I've now been, let's say, an astronomer with my little 8-inch, and I've got my 32-millimeter Plossel and my Type 4 12-millimeter Nagler, the mid-power one, and I'm very happy. And now I'm so excited I graduate up, and I'm looking to maybe get a 10-inch or really go the bucks and get a 14-inch because I'm really excited. Are those eyepieces still compatible with those size telescopes?
Absolutely, absolutely. You'll find, in fact, again, on our website, you can see the magnifications instantly and how far you want to go. And you're really basically only limited by the magnification. In a reflector, you don't want to go too big in exit pupil or too low in power, or the shadow of the secondary becomes visible and annoying. So that is one limitation you have to worry about, and that's also discussed on our magnification article. But basically, with those caveats, that you don't want too long a focal length to get too big an exit pupil, if you limit yourself to around 7 millimeters, you'll be safe with any telescope. So you just divide the eyepiece focal length divided by the telescope F number. So if you took a 55-millimeter Plossel divided by 10 millimeters, F10 rather, you get 5.5-millimeter exit pupil and you're safe. Where you have to be concerned is, if, let's say you got a big Dobsonian. That's a fast telescope, and that puts more stress on the eyepiece in terms of design and, as an aside, forces you to choose higher quality eyepieces. But aside from that, if you put that same 55-millimeter eyepiece on an F5 telescope, you're going to get an 11-millimeter exit pupil, which is too big because you get this big black secondary in the middle of your eye pupil, and it's very annoying, cuts light and everything else. So you have to know a little bit about your limits, but as far as the style or type of eyepiece, there's only basically inch and a quarter and 2-inch sizes, depending upon what focuser you have. And of course, an inch and a quarter will always fit in a 2-inch. And you only have to look out for too lower power to get too big an exit pupil in a reflector at the low power end. And at the high power end, you basically are limited by the atmosphere and what the telescope can do. And I don't think, except in rare instances, that any telescope can be effectively used above 300 power. I know that the only place I've seen personally where that rule can be abrogated is maybe in the Florida Keys at the Winter Star Party, which seems to have the best seeing conditions I've ever seen. But generally, you want to watch the powers at the high end and the exit pupil at the low end, and every eyepiece can be used in between. It's just that we recommend, of course, our eyepieces, because they're designed to work at very fast speeds effectively, which means it'll give you the best image in any telescope, whether it's slow speed or fast.
One question that actually you brought up early that you said we might get into later, so I don't want to lose that, is another issue about coma correction. Now, you have introduced a coma corrector. So tell us about coma correction.
Okay, the concept there is, you know we make a series of high quality flat field refractors, and they give spectacular wide angle views, as you know, and as Stephen O'Mara has extolled in his books with his 4-inch Genesis.
Yeah.
And the thought came to mind, well, if we can have these great wide angle sharp views in a refractor, wouldn't it be wonderful to have equally sharp views in a big reflector? And the limitation there is coma. It turns out that only a couple of millimeters in the center of the field is truly sharp, and even a perfect parabola, a fast one at any rate, will smear out the image into a coma pattern. Now, it turns out that when we improved our eyepieces, the images generally looked so much better that people thought this was a revolution and we're all done. But we're not done, because the coma is another major limitation in a fast telescope. And the stars just blur out at the edge of the field. And this paracore, which means parabola corrector, when inserted like a Barlow lens, in a fast Newtonian, eliminates the coma and allows both the telescope and the eyepiece to be fully compatible and fully sharp over the field of view. So to me, the development of the paracore coma corrector was a complete analogy to what I was doing with our fast flat field refractors.
And before we finish up, Al, I think it's very important that we talk a bit about your family and how I'm sure it's one of the great joys of your life and career that you've been able to bring members of your family into Teleview in a very active
I'm
role.
I'm absolutely delighted that you give me the opportunity to bring that up, because I happen to have a painting done by Hewlin Fleming of a visit to Stellafane, which shows my complete family at my favorite place in the world, mm-hmm. Stellafane, and I look at it every day. I see it at home, and I see it here. And, of course, my wife, Judy, has supported me in all of this, all of these years. And as we speak, she's on the phone talking to a customer right now. And my son, David, who's been with us 15 years now, coming out of a degree in communications, has done a lot of our literature, and he knows so much now technically that he reminds me when I start forgetting about where to go when I'm talking to customers. So we have this great family team, and it is a family run business, and we like to keep it that way. And it really come from the philosophy of treating our customers as family as well, as you well know.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. Al, tell us a little bit in the time remaining about the line of telescopes that you've come out with.
Okay, we have refractors, which I like because of the high contrast, sharp images, versatility for photography, wide fields. You can get fields of view up to 5 degrees showing all 3 sections of the Veil Nebula and so on, and yet you plug in a high-powered eyepiece and you got great views of Saturn and Mars and so on at the highest powers. So for me, as a hobbyist, and you have to understand that I am now classifying myself as the world's laziest amateur astronomer. So that's where I'm coming from. I kind of want it all. I want it now. I want it quick, and I want it easy.
That's so a lot of us.
The idea is to make small, compact, fine instruments that have all this versatility for both visual, wide-angle, high-power photography, CCD, nature study. We have another website which your people might want to look at called birdscope.com, because some of our telescopes are top-rated and in this crossover market between birding and astronomy. And to me, all of nature is a continuum. And when I see a bird or an insect or a flower, I marvel almost as much as seeing the Orion Nebula these days. So that's where our telescope lines come from. And it turns out, to get this wide field in a telescope, you need a fast, highly corrected system. And lo and behold, you need fast, highly corrected eyepieces. So it works out nicely that for both Dobsonians on the big aperture end and our small light travel refractors, if you will, on the smaller end, that the eyepieces become a very synergistic part of the system.
All of nature is a continuum. I think that those words should be inscribed in stone somewhere. The night before last, I got a photograph of a screech owl who had taken a perch up on a post in our yard, and I was able to frame it so that the gibbous moon was in the background right below the bird's beak. And
it actually looks like the bird has a puffed nose, because it looks like the gibbous moon is its peak.
Yeah. And it is so incredible what you just said. Al Nagler, thank you so much for joining us on Let's Talk Stars today. I think you've educated us a lot on the importance of eyepieces and on the tradition of eyepieces in astronomy. Al, thanks very much again. You've been listening to Let's Talk Stars.
The preceding program was produced and paid for by Star Arizona.